Chapter 28. A Simple Question. Care Prey led me to the twin stools by the pantry. After removing some leather-bound books from the seats, we sat down. Shim, for his part, had already climbed onto the pantry's bottom shelf and seemed very comfortable, surrounded by ample supplies for his supper. The poet observed me silently for several seconds. "You have changed since I last saw you. Quite a lot. So much, I didn't even recognize you at first. Though you could, I suppose, say the same about me. It has been 5 or 6 years, after all." I could not contain my excitement.
"You have met me before? And my mother as well?"
His eyes darkened. "You don't remember?"
"I don't remember any of my childhood. Up to the day I washed ashore, it's all a mystery."
I grasped the sleeve of his white tunic.
"But you can help me. You can answer my questions. Tell me everything you can first about my mother. Who is she? Where is she? Why did you say she was a friend?"
Care Prey leaned back on his stool, clasping his knee with both hands. "It seems as though I will be telling you a story after all." After a pause, he began. "There came a day when a woman, a human woman, arrived on the shores of this island. She came from the land of the Celts, from a place called Gunnedd." A sudden pang of doubt struck me. Had I been wrong all along about Branwen? Hesitantly, I asked,
"What was her name?"
"Elen." I breathed a sigh of relief. "Now, Elen looked very different from us Finkirans. Her skin was lighter than most, more creamy than ruddy. Her ears were shaped differently, too, more round than triangular. Truly she was beautiful. But her most striking feature was her eyes. They glowed with a color unlike any ever seen on this island, pure blue. Untinted with gray or brown, blue as a sapphire. So she was called Elen of the Sapphire Eyes." I shuddered. "She came here," he continued, "because of her love for a man of Finkirin blood, a man from this world, not her own. And soon after she arrived, she discovered yet another love." He glanced around the room. "Books. She loved books, from all lands and all languages. In fact, we met over a book when she came here to collect one I had borrowed that was slightly overdue. A decade or so. After that, she came here often to read and talk. She sat in the very chair where you sit now. Especially, she was interested in the art of healing, as it has been practiced through the ages. She herself had a gift for healing others." Again, I shuddered. Remembering something, Care Prey smiled to himself. "But her favorite books of all, I think, were the stories of the Greeks." "Is this true?" I demanded. "Do you swear this is true?"
"It is."
"She told me so little, not even her name. She only called herself Branwen."
Care Prey turned toward a high shelf of books.
"How like her to choose a name from legend. Yet it grieves me to hear that she chose such a tragic one."
"Alas, that I was ever born," I quoted.
The poet gazed at me.
"So you know the legend?"
"I know it."
My lower lip trembled.
"But I didn't know her. Not at all. She said so little about herself that I refused."
A knot filled my throat, and I started to sob quietly. The poet watched me with the compassion of someone feeling the same stab of pain, yet he did not try to comfort me. He merely let me shed the tears that I needed to shed. Finally, in a hoarse whisper, I finished the sentence.
"I refused to call her mother."
Care Prey said nothing for some time. When at last he spoke, he asked a simple question.
"Did she love you?"
Raising my head, I nodded slowly.
Yes.
Did she care for you when you needed help?
Yes.
Then you did know her. You knew her down to her soul. I wiped my cheeks with my tunic.
Perhaps. But it doesn't feel that way. Can you tell me some about my father?
A strange, faraway look came into Kaer Prey's eyes.
Your father was an impressive youth, strong, willful, passionate, full of zest, the ardent quest. No, the rhythm's all wrong. Let me try again. Awake, alive, a startling drive. There, that's better. In our most ancient tongue, his name means tree climber, because as a boy he so enjoyed climbing trees. Sometimes he would even climb to the top of a tall tree and stay there just for the experience of riding out a fierce storm.
I laughed out loud, understanding more fully than the poet knew. Yet Tree Climber's childhood, I believe, was far from joyous. His mother, Olin, was a daughter of the sea, one of those beings the Earthfolk call Myr people, though Finkairans prefer people of the Myr. So he, like you, was born with the strange depths of the sea in his bones. Yet Olin's long journey came too soon.
I've heard about this long journey.
Kaer Prey sighed.
And long it is, arduous too, according to the glories of Dagda. Unless, of course, you happen to be one of the few who are taken to the other world right in the moment of death. But that is rare. Extremely rare.
You were talking about my father?
Oh, yes, your father. Since Olen died when he was but an infant, your father was reared by his own father, a Finkairan known as Tuatha, son of Vinvara. Now, Tuatha was a masterful wizard and a powerful man. It is said that even the great spirit Dagda would sometimes come to his home to confer on high matters. But alas, this wizard had very little time for his own son's needs. And Tuatha had even less time when he discovered, when your father was about the age you are now, that the boy lacked the gift of making magic, the powers, as Tuatha called them.
I swallowed hard, knowing that such powers were not a gift, but a curse. I recalled the prophecy of my grandfather as told to me by Branwen, Elen, my mother, that she would one day have a son who would possess powers even greater than his own, whose magic would spring from the very deepest sources. Such folly. He might have been a great wizard, but he could not have been more wrong.
Your father's life changed, however, when he first met Elen during one of his travels to Earth. They fell deeply in love. Although it is rarely done, and still more rarely done with success, this man and woman of different worlds were married. Elen came to live in Finkaira. And because of her love, a new strength came into his heart, a new calm into his eye. The loving bond may reach beyond. Their happiness was great, for a time, though I am afraid that time was all too brief.
Grasping the edge of the stool where my own mother had sat long ago, I leaned forward.
What happened?
Kaer Prey's face, so serious already, grew still more serious.
Your father, he began, then paused to clear his throat. Your father was part of the royal circle of Stangmar. When the evil spirit Rita Gaur, who has long had designs on Finkaira, began courting the king, your father was present, and your father, like the rest of the circle, slipped gradually into trouble. The same trouble that eventually corrupted the king, as well as the whole of Finkaira.
Didn't my father try to resist Rita Gaur? Didn't he try to keep the king from listening to him?
If he tried, he failed. The poet sighed. You must understand, many good people have been fooled by Rita Gaur's treachery. Your father was only one of them.
I felt heavier than a boulder.
So, my father helped to bring the blight
to Finkyra?
That is true, but all of us bear some of the blame.
What do you mean?
Caerprey winced, so painful was the memory. It all happened gradually, you see, so gradually that no one quite understood what was happening until it was too late. No one but Stangmar himself understands just how it started. All anyone else knows is that somehow Rita Gower offered to protect the king in a time of need. To have refused this help would have placed the king, and therefore Finkyra, in some sort of danger. Rita Gower must have planned it out very carefully, because he made it almost impossible for the king not to accept his help. And Stangmar did just that. He paused to lift a small brown moth off his white collar and place it gently on top of a pile of books by his stool. That one little decision has led to a cascade of tragedies, one after another. When Rita Gower convinced Stangmar that his enemies were plotting to overthrow him, the king forged a questionable alliance with the warrior goblins and the shifting wraiths. Out of their dark crevasses they crawled. Then came the rumors that the giants, Finkyra's most ancient people, had suddenly become dangerous. Not only to the king, but to the rest of us as well. So not many objected when Stangmar ordered the giants hunted down. Giants always seemed so different to most people. Those of us who did object were either ridiculed or battered into silence. Next, Stangmar heeded Rita Gower's warnings and began a campaign to cleanse the land of all the king's enemies, and to confiscate the treasures of Finkyra, because they might somehow fall into enemy hands.
Didn't anyone try to stop this?
Some brave souls tried, but they were too few and too late. Stangmar stamped out any opposition, burning whole villages to the ground on the slightest suspicion of treason. Yet even that was preferable to what he did to the village of Caer Nahan.
I jumped. You mean the town of the bards?
You know of it? Oh, what a loss to our world and all the others. For ages beyond memory, that town has been a fountain of music and song, home of our most inspired storytellers, nurturer of generations of bards. Lane the Lame was born there. Powych wrote her first poem there. The Vessel of Illusion was composed there. I could go on and on. Here song is ever in the air, while story climbs the spiral stair. With a nod, I observed the words on the sign. Quite so. They were written in truth, though now they are but a mockery. I should know, since I wrote them myself. He sighed. Caer Nahan was my birthplace as well.
What happened there?
Caerprey studied me sadly for a while. Of all the fabled treasures stolen by Stangmar, the sword Deepakut that can slice to the soul, the flowering harp that can call forth the spring, the cauldron of death that can end any life, the one most celebrated by bards throughout time was the Caller of Dreams. It was a horn with the power to bring wondrous dreams to life, and for centuries it was used only sparingly and wisely. But with the help of Rita Gower, Stangmar used it to punish Caer Nahan for harboring some who dared to oppose his policies. He called to life the most horrible dream ever beheld by any bard, and inflicted it upon the entire town. Remembering the half-crazed eyes of the man with the spear, I was almost afraid to ask, "What dream was that?" The poet's eyes grew cloudy. That every man, woman, and child in that village would never speak, nor sing, nor write again. That the instruments of their souls, their very voices, would be silenced forever. His voice a mere whisper, he continued, "By this time, no one was left to protest when Rita Gower urged Stangmar to destroy his own castle, the grandest yet most welcoming home any king or queen could ever ask for.
including its library of books, a library more vast than my own by a thousandfold.
And why? On the grounds that it was not safe enough from attack.
So Rita Gaur, calling it a gesture of friendship, no doubt, built a new castle for Stangmar, a castle infused with his own evil power.
Thus arose the Shrouded Castle, ever spinning on its foundation, from which spreads the impenetrable cloud that now darkens our sky, and the terrible blight that now strangles our soil.
He rubbed his chin. The castle is guarded by Rita Gaur's own deathless warriors, the Gulians. Their lives, if you can call them lives, for they are actually men whose bodies were raised from the dead by Rita Gaur, will never end, at least not by mortal blows. For their lives are sustained by the very turning of the Shrouded Castle. So long as the castle keeps turning, they will remain there, performing deeds even darker than the Shroud itself.
I ached for Rhea. If she was still alive, she was probably in the bowels of that very castle. She would be at the mercy of the Gulians and of Stangmar himself. What would become of her when he concluded that she neither could nor would help him obtain the Galator, the last treasure? I shuddered at the thought, and I despaired at the Grand Delusa's belief that the only way to topple Stangmar was to destroy the Shrouded Castle. I might as well wish to sprout wings.
Now you can see, Caer Prey added, that Stangmar is truly the prisoner of Rita Gaur. And as Stangmar is imprisoned, so are we all.
Why hasn't Dagda intervened to stop all this? He is battling Rita Gaur on other fronts, isn't he?
That he is, in the other world as well as in this world. But Dagda believes, as Rita Gaur does not, that to win, ultimately he must respect people's free will. Dagda allows us to make our own choices, for good or ill. So if Finkaira is to be saved, it must be saved by the Finkairans.
Chapter 29 Lost Wings. Caer Prey reached around Shim, who had managed to spread himself, as well as Clover Honey, across the pantry shelf. The long-haired man tore off a slab of dark, grainy bread and ripped it in half. Keeping one piece, he handed me the other.
Here, before your little friend eats it all.
Shim did not seem to notice and continued stuffing himself. I half grinned and took a bite of the crusty bread. It felt hard, almost like wood, until some vigorous chewing softened it up a bit. Then, to my surprise, it swiftly dissolved into liquid, filling my mouth with a tangy, minty flavor. Almost as soon as I swallowed, a wave of nourishment flowed through me. I straightened my back. Even the usual pain between my shoulder blades eased a little. I took another bite.
You like ambrosia bread, I can see, said Caer Prey through a mouthful. One of the Slanto's finest achievements, without doubt. Still, it is said that no one from other parts of Finkaira has ever tasted any of the Slanto's most special breads, and that they guard those precious recipes with their lives.
I scanned the walls and floor of the room so densely jammed with volumes. Being here felt like being in the hold of a ship whose cargo consisted of nothing but books. I remembered Branwyn's wistful look when she had spoken about being in a room full of books, this very one, no doubt. Even with the spreading blight, it must have been difficult for her to leave this room, this land, forever. I turned back to Caer Prey. My mother must have loved being here with all your books.
Indeed she did. She wanted to read the teachings of the Finkairans, the Druids, the Celts, the Jews, the Christians, the Greeks. She called herself my student, but it was really more the other way around. I learned so much from her.
He glanced at a mound of books at the base of the ladder. On the leather cover of the book on top, a gold-leaf portrait showing a figure driving a blazing chariot gleamed in the light of the hearth fire.
"I remember once," he said in a distant voice, "when we talked the whole night through about those remarkable places where beings of mortal flesh and beings of immortal spirit live side by side, where time flows both in a line and in a circle, where sacred time and historical time exist together, in between places," she called them.
"Like Mount Olympus,"
the poet nodded, "or like Phincyra."
"Was it all the mounting troubles that made her want to leave Phincyra, or was there something more?"
He eyed me strangely.
"Your suspicion is correct. There was something more."
"What?"
"You, my boy."
My brow furrowed.
"I don't understand."
"Let me explain. Do you know about the Greek Isle of Delos?"
"Apollo's birthplace. But what does that have to do with me?"
"It was another in-between place, both sacred and historical at once. That is why the Greeks never allowed anyone to give birth on Delos. They didn't want any mere mortal to be able to claim a birthright to soil that belonged first to the gods. And they killed or banished anyone foolish enough to disobey."
"I still don't see what this has to do with me."
At this moment, Shim released an immense belch, far bigger than one would expect from a person so small. Yet the little giant did not seem aware of it, just as he seemed to have forgotten about Carepray and myself. He merely patted his belly and returned to the serious matter of fresh clover honey. Carepray's shaggy eyebrows lifted in amusement, then his expression darkened.
"In the same manner as Delos, it is strictly forbidden that anyone with human blood should ever be born on the island of Phincyra. This is a land not of the earth, nor of the other world, though it is a bridge between them both. Visitors come here from either world, and they sometimes stay for years, yet they cannot call this place home."
I leaned closer. "I have been searching for my own home, so help me understand this. If my mother had to leave Phincyra to give birth to me, where did she go? Do you know where I was born?"
"I know," replied the poet, his tone grave. "It was not where you should have been born."
I caught my breath.
"Are you saying that I was born on Phincyra, even though I have human blood?"
His face told me everything.
"Does that mean I am in danger?"
"More danger than you know."
"How did that happen? You said it is forbidden."
"I can explain what, but not why."
Carepray scratched the top of his head.
"It happened this way. Your parents, aware of Phincyra's ancient law, knew that Elene must sail to another land to give birth. But they also knew that no one can be sure when setting sail from Phincyra whether or not he or she will ever return. The passage here is a strange one, as you are well aware. Sometimes the door is open, sometimes it is not. Many who have left this island hoping desperately to return have found only a shred of mist upon the waters. Others have met their deaths in the stormy seas. Nothing is known, but we sail alone." He shook his head. "Your mother and father loved each other deeply and did not want to part. If Tuatha had not commanded your father to stay, I believe he would have sailed with her. Moreover, I suspect that Elene could sense trouble brewing and did not want to leave him. So they lingered long before parting, too long. Your mother was already in her 9th month when at last she set sail."
Feeling something warm against my chest, I looked down at my tunic. Beneath the folds, the Galator was glowing faintly, making a circle of green light over my heart. Swiftly, I covered the place with my hand, hoping that Caerprey would not notice and interrupt his tale.
Soon after the ship had launched, a terrible storm arose on the waves. It was a kind of storm that few sailors since Odysseus have survived. The ship was battered, nearly drowned, and forced back to shore. That very night, huddled in the wreckage of the ship, your mother gave birth.
He paused, thinking.
And she named the boy Emrys, a Celtic name from her homeland.
So that is my true name?
Not necessarily. Your true name may not be your given name.
I gave a nod of understanding.
Emrys has never felt right to me. But how do I find my true name?
The deep-set eyes pondered me.
Life will find it for you.
I don't know what you mean.
With luck, you will in time.
Well, my true name is a mystery. But at least now, I know I belong in Fincaira.
Caerprey shook his gray head.
You do, and you do not.
But you said I was born here.
Your place of birth may not be where you belong.
Feeling a surge of frustration, I pulled the Galator out of my tunic. Its jeweled center, still glowing faintly, flared in the light of the fire.
She gave me this. Does this not prove I belong here?
A new depth of sadness filled the pools beneath Caerprey's brows.
The Galator belongs here, yes. Whether or not you belong here, I do not know.
Exasperated, I demanded, must I destroy the castle and the king and all his army before you will tell me I belong here?
I may tell you that one day, answered the poet calmly, if you tell me the same.
His demeanor, if not his words, soothed me somewhat. I replaced the pendant under my tunic. Feeling again the pain between my shoulder blades, I stretched my arms out wide. Caerprey observed me knowingly.
So you too feel the pain. In that way you are certainly a son of Fincaira.
This pain in my shoulders? How should that make any difference?
It has made all the difference in the world.
Seeing the confusion in my face, he once again leaned back on his stool, clasped his knee, and began to tell a story. In the far, far reaches of time, the people of Fincaira walked upon the land, as they do now, yet they also could do something else.
They also could fly.
My eyes widened.
The gift of flight was theirs. They had lovely white wings, the old legends say, sprouting from between their shoulder blades, so they could soar with the eagles and sail with the clouds, wings of white to endless height. They could venture high above the lands of Fincaira, or even to lands beyond.
For an instant I could almost feel the flutter of the feisty hawk, who would swoop through the air before landing on my shoulder. Trouble had so enjoyed the gift of flight. I missed him, almost as much as I missed Rhea. I smiled sadly at Caerprey.
So the Fincairans had both the ears of demons and the wings of angels.
He looked amused.
That's a poetic way to put it.
What happened to their wings?
They lost them, though it's not clear how. That is one story that has not survived, though I would gladly give away half of my books just to hear it. Whatever happened, it took place so long ago that many Fincairans have never even heard that their ancestors could fly. Or if they have, they simply dismiss it as untrue.
I watched the poet.
But you believe it's true?
I do.
I know someone else who would believe it. My friend Rhea. She would love to be able to fly.
I bit my lip.
First, though, I must save her, if she still lives.
What happened to her?
Carried off by goblins. She tricked them into taking her instead of me, though what they really wanted was the Galator. She is probably at the Shrouded Castle by now.
Caerprey tilted his head, frowning. From that angle, his face looked like a stern statue made of stone rather than flesh. At last he spoke, his resonant voice filling the room so crowded with books.
"Do you know the prophecy of the giant's dance?"
I tried to recall it. "Only when giants make dance in the hall shall every..."
"Barrier."
"Shall every barrier crumble and fall." "But I don't have any hope of destroying the castle. All I can hope to do is save my friend."
"And what if that requires destroying the shrouded castle?"
"Then all is lost."
"No doubt you are correct. Destroying the castle would destroy Rita Gower's presence in Finkaira, and neither he nor Stangmar is about to let that happen. A warrior as great as Hercules would find it impossible, even if he carried some weapon of enormous power."
Suddenly an idea struck me. Perhaps the Galator is the key. It is, after all, the last treasure, the one that Stangmar has been searching for.
Caerpre's shaggy mane wagged from side to side.
"We know very little about the Galator."
"Can you at least tell me what its powers are?"
"No, except that they are described in the ancient texts as vast beyond knowing."
"You're no help at all."
"Too true."
Caerpre's sad face brightened, only a little.
"I can, however, give you my own theory about the Galator."
"Tell me."
"I believe that its powers, whatever they are, respond to love."
"Love?"
"Yes." The poet's gaze rambled over his shelves of books. "You shouldn't be so surprised. Stories about the power of love abound." He stroked his chin. "As a start, I believe the Galator glows in the presence of love. Do you recall what we were talking about when it started shining under your tunic?"
I hesitated.
"Was it my mother?"
"Yes. Ellen of the Sapphire Eyes, the woman who loved you enough to give up everything in her life in order to save yours. That, if you really want to know the truth, is why she left Finkaira."
For a long while, I could find no words to speak. Finally, I said regretfully,
"What an ass I was! Never calling her my mother, never putting her pain ahead of my own. I wish I could tell her how sorry I am."
Caerpre lowered his eyes.
"As long as you stay in Finkaira, you will never have that chance. When she left, she swore she would never come back."
"She should never have given me the Galator. I know absolutely nothing about how it works or what it can do."
"I just told you my theory."
"Your theory is mad. You say it glows in the presence of love? Well, you should know that I've seen it glow once before, since I came back to Finkaira, in the presence of a bloodthirsty spider."
Caerpre froze.
"Not the Grand Elusa?"
"Yes."
He almost smiled.
"That strengthens my theory all the more. Do not be fooled by the Grand Elusa's alarming appearance. The truth is, her love is as great as her appetite."
I shrugged.
"Even if your theory is correct, what good does it do? It doesn't help me save Rhea."
"Are you determined to go after her?"
"I am."
He scowled.
"Do you know what the odds are against you?"
"I have some idea."
"But you don't."
Caerpre stood up and started pacing down the narrow path between the stacks of books. His thigh brushed against one large, illuminated volume, and it fell to the floor in an explosion of dust. As he bent to retrieve it, stuffing loose pages back between the covers, he looked my way.
"You remind me of Prometheus, so certain he could steal the fire of the gods."
"I'm not that certain. I just know I must try. Besides, Prometheus finally succeeded, didn't he?"
"Yes," exclaimed the poet, "at the price of eternal torture, being chained to a rock where an eagle would gnaw forever upon his liver."
until Hercules rescued him.
Caerprey's face reddened. I can see that I taught your mother too well. You are right that Prometheus found freedom in the end, but you are wrong if you think for a minute that you will be so fortunate. Out there in the lands controlled by Stangmar, people are at risk just by showing themselves. You must understand me. All your mother's sacrifices will have been wasted if you go to the Shrouded Castle.
I folded my arms. While I certainly did not feel courageous, I did feel resolved. I must try to save Rhea.
He stopped pacing. You are no less stubborn than your mother.
That sounds to me like a compliment.
He shook his head in defeat. All right, then, you ignore my warnings. The withered breath approaching death. I suppose, then, I should at least give you some advice that might conceivably help.
I slid off my stool. What is it?
More likely, though, it will only hasten your death.
Please tell me.
There is one person in all of Finkaira who might have the power to help you enter the castle, though I doubt that even she can help you beyond that point. Her powers are old, very old, springing from the same ancient sources that brought the very first giants into being. That is why Stangmar fears to crush her. Even Rita Gower himself prefers to leave her alone.
Caerprey stepped closer, wading through the sea of books.
Whether or not she will choose to help you, I cannot say. No one can. For her ways are mysterious and unpredictable. She is neither good nor evil, friend nor foe. She simply is. In legend, she is called Damnu, which means dark fate. Her true name, if it ever was known, has been lost to time.
He glanced at Shim, now sleeping soundly on the pantry shelf, his hand inside the empty jar of honey.
You and your little friend may not have the pleasure of meeting her, however. Getting into her lair will be very dangerous. He added under his breath, though not as dangerous as getting out again.
I shivered slightly.
To find her, you must start before sunrise. Although the light of dawn is now only a pale glow through the spreading darkness, it will be your best guide, for just to the north of the sunrise, you will see a notch cut deep into the ridge of the highest row of hills.
I should head for the notch?
Caerprey nodded in assent, and you will miss it at your peril. If you cross the ridge to the north of the notch, you will find yourself in the middle of Stangmar's largest encampment of goblins.
I sucked in my breath. No risk of that.
And if you cross the ridge to the south of the notch, you will be even worse off, for you will enter the Haunted Marsh.
No risk of that, either.
At that moment, Shim released a loud, prolonged snort. The books lining the shelves seemed to jump in surprise, as did Caerprey and I. The poet frowned, but continued. Passing through the notch itself will not be easy. It is guarded by warrior goblins. How many, I don't know, but even one can mean trouble enough. Your best hope is that these days they are unused to travelers, for reasons you can well understand. It is just possible they will not be paying much attention. There is at least a chance you could slip past them.
Then what?
You must proceed straight down the ridge, being careful not to veer to one side or the other until you reach a steep canyon. Eagles once soared among its cliffs, but no more, since now the canyon is always darker than night. Turn south, following the canyon to the very edge of the Haunted Marsh. If you make it that far, you will encounter the lair of Damnu. But not before you have met some other creatures almost as strange as she is. Feeling weak, I leaned against my stool.
What does her lair look like?
I have no idea. You see, no one who has ever ventured there has ever returned to describe it. All I can tell you is that, according to legend,
Damnu has a passion for games of chance and wagers, and dearly hates to lose.
Caerpre bent down to the floor and pushed a pile of books aside. He threw a sheepskin on the spot. With deep sadness, he said,
"If you mean to pursue this idea of yours, you had better try to rest now. Sunrise will come before long."
He pondered my face.
"I can see by the scars on your cheeks and the strange distance in your eyes that this is not the first time you have shown bravery. Perhaps I have underestimated you. Perhaps you possess all the hidden strengths of your forebears and more."
I waved away the comment. "If you knew me better, you would know that I am no credit to my forebears. I have no special powers, at least none that I can use. All I have is a stubborn head and the Galator around my neck."
He rubbed his chin thoughtfully. "Time will tell. But I will say this. When first you entered my home, I was looking for an answer in some forgotten volume. Now I am wondering whether I should be looking for that answer in some forgotten person."
Wearily I stretched myself out on the sheepskin.
For some time I lay awake, watching the firelight dance on the walls of books, the scrolls of papyrus, the piles of manuscripts. Caerpre had returned to his high-backed chair, absorbed in his reading.
So this is where my mother learned her stories. I felt a swell of desire to stay many days in this room filled with books, to travel wherever their pages might carry me. Perhaps one day I would do just that. But I knew that I must travel somewhere else first, and that I must depart before dawn.
Chapter 30. To Aelin and Garlatha. Shim scrunched his pear-shaped nose in puzzlement.
"Why is she called Damnu? That is muchly strange."
"Damnu," I replied, pushing myself up from the sheepskin. "I've told you everything I know, which isn't much." I glanced at Caerpre, fast asleep in his chair with three open books in his lap. His long gray hair fell over his face like a waterfall.
"Now, it is time to go."
Shim's gaze moved to the pantry, whose bottom shelf glistened from spilled honey.
"I is not gladly to leave this place."
"You don't have to come, you know. I will understand if you want to stay." The pink eyes kindled.
"Really, truly, honestly?"
"Yes. I am sure Caerpre will make you welcome, although he probably doesn't have much food left." The little giant smacked his lips. Then, glancing toward the wooden ladder up the tunnel, his expression clouded.
"But you is going?"
"I am going. Now." For a few seconds, I studied the little face at my knee. Shim had turned out to be not such a bad companion after all. I took one of his tiny hands in my own.
"Wherever you go, may you find plenty of honey there."
Shim scowled.
"I is not happy about going."
"I know. Farewell."
I moved to the ladder and grasped a worn rung. Shim ran over and pulled on my tunic.
"But I is not happy about staying, either."
"You should stay."
"Is you not wanting me?"
"This will be too dangerous for you."
Shim growled with resentment.
"You is not saying that. If I is a real giant, big and strong, then you begs me to come."
Sadly, I smiled.
"Maybe so, but I still like you the way you are."
The little fellow grimaced.
"I don't. I still wish as I am big. Big as the highliest tree."
"You know, when Rhea was irked at me once, she told me, 'Just be yourself.' I've thought about it now and then. It's much easier to say than to do, but she had a point."
"Ma, not if you don't likes the self you are being."
"Listen, Shim, I understand. Believe me, I do. Just try being at home with who you are."
I paused, a little surprised to hear myself say such a thing. Then, with a final look around Caerpre's crowded walls of books, I began climbing up the tunnel. As I squeezed through the door in the stump, I scanned the eastern horizon. Dry, reddish soil stretched as far as I could see, broken only by the occasional scrawny tree or cluster of thorned bracken. Although no birds were around to announce the dawn, a faint line of light was already appearing above the dark hills, which stood blacker than coal. To the north of the glow, I made out two sharp knobs, divided by a narrow gap, the notch. Standing beside the stump, I concentrated on the formation, trying to memorize its position. I did not want to miss the notch, even by a small margin. And I couldn't be certain it would remain visible as the day progressed. Seeing my staff on the ground, I stooped to pick it up. Dew frosted its twisted top, making the wood slippery and cold to the touch. Suddenly, I noticed several deep gashes along the shaft. Teeth marks. I had no way to tell what kind of beast had made them. I only knew that they had not been there when I climbed down into Carepre's tunnel last night. I reached to close the door when Shim's bulbous nose emerged. The little body followed, clambering through the opening.
I is coming.
Are you sure?
I showed him the staff.
Whatever chewed on this last night could still be near.
Shim swallowed, but said nothing. I waved toward the dimly glowing horizon.
And to find Domnu, we have to make it through that notch in the dark hills. No room for error, either. To one side lies an army of goblins, to the other lies the haunted marsh.
The little giant planted his feet firmly.
You is not leaving me.
All right, then. Come.
Hopping over the trickling stream by the stump, I strode off in the direction of the notch. Shim, hustling to keep up, followed. For the rest of that morning, if such grim, lightless hours could be called morning, we trekked across the open tundra. The soil crackled under the weight of our feet. Heading toward the notched ridge, we followed no roads or trails, though we crossed several. Yet the roads were as empty as the village that had been burned to the ground. Conversation was just as sparse as the surrounding vegetation and almost as brittle, for both of us knew how easily we could be spotted by anyone loyal to Stangmar. Even when Shim reached into the pocket of his shirt and offered to share a hunk of ambrosia bread from Caerpre's pantry, he did so without speaking. I merely nodded in thanks, and we pressed on. As the land gradually lifted toward the dark hills, I did my best to guide us. Although the notch no longer stood out against the sky, as it did during the brief glow that had passed for sunrise, it remained barely visible. Yet it seemed to me less a sign of the route than a sign of foreboding. Suppose we somehow passed through the notch and even made it to Stangmar's castle, only to find that Rhea was not there, or worse, that she was there, but no longer alive. Every so often we encountered sparse signs of habitation. An old house here, a dilapidated pen there, yet these structures seemed as lifeless as the landscape. They sat there, rotting, like bones on a beach. If anyone still lived there, they lived in hiding, and they existed somehow without trees or gardens or greenery of any kind. Then, to my surprise, I sensed a subtle splash of green ahead. Thinking it might be just a mistake of my weak vision, I concentrated on the spot. Yet the color seemed real enough, contrasting with the rusty browns and grays on all sides. As I drew nearer, the green deepened. At the same time, I detected the outlines of trees, arranged in regular rows with some sort of fruit clinging to their boughs.
An orchard! Can you believe it?
Shim rubbed his nose.
Looks dangerously to me.
And see? I pointed at a boxy shape behind the trees. There's some sort of hut in the cleft of the hill.
I thinks we better stays away, really, truly, absolutely.